The content of this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as financial or investment advice. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the hosts and their guests. They do not necessarily reflect the position of any associated employers or organizations.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the second episode of Applied MMT. Our goal for this podcast is to discuss current events in the economy through an MMT lens. Today, we talk about the debt ceiling, recession fears, and other issues like minting the platinum $1 trillion coin. Thank you for listening. We're excited to keep this podcast going. Ryan, I'm going to kick us off. I think, we had some big news today. The GDP numbers came out, and GDP in the fourth quarter is higher than expected at 2.9%. Which to me indicates that we're not in a recession. And I know it's something that you and I have talked about for a while, that kind of this recession has become a meme. And my personal thinking on it, my take on it, is that a lot of the recession talk was politically motivated around the election, you know, trying to get people to believe that there was a recession, and there would be a recession, and trying to get people to vote for the opposite party. And then I think there's been a kind of a confluence of things with all these layoffs of big tech companies, and people conflate those layoffs with a recession in the wider economy. But by all indications, the economy is doing pretty well. And I think, you know, I would love to talk about that from an MMT perspective and why we think that is. But yeah, would love to hear your thoughts just to get us going today.
Well, first of all, Adam, I mean, you and I were texting each other so much last fall, saying like, are we missing something? I kind of think this whole recession narrative is exactly that, and just a narrative. And there's all this fear mongering, and people talking about the rate hikes and the Fed tightening. I mean, first of all, last time I checked, I don't know about you, but if I have $10,000 in a savings account, and I buy a U.S. Treasury bill, right? Because rates are higher now, right? If I, if I'm getting paid 4% on that, I end the year with $10,400 in my savings account. Whereas if rates are at zero, then I end up the year with only $10,000 in my account. So I don't really understand how that can be a form of tightening, as it's generally referred to. But yeah, it's just, I feel like, not that we didn't really have the podcast going last fall, but I don't know about you. I feel a little bit of vindication and like a little bit of a victory lap. I don't know. I mean, I guess the consensus was for, closer to, 2.5% GDP growth. It came in, initial estimates are saying closer to 3%. I mean, who could have seen this coming, right?
Right. And I think, if you're approaching the economy with that kind of conventional lens, and you're only focusing on interest rates, I can understand why you'd think there might be a recession, given just how rapid the rate hikes were. But like we talked about in the first episode, and I think really only MMT understands this, is that, you know, there's another side of the coin here, and that interest payments have gone way up, and most of the commentary just ignores the fiscal side of the story. You know, there's when it comes to predicting the economy going forward, there's no talk about increased government spending. There's no talk about the CHIPS bill. There's no talk about the increased Social Security payments that are going out as of 2023. There's no talk about, the student loan policies. I feel like I'm missing something. Was there another one I'm missing?
The Inflation Reduction Act.
Yes, the Inflation Reduction Act. And if you're ignoring all of that fiscal policy, and you're only looking at it from a monetary policy lens, you know, and the interest rate changes, I can understand through that conventional lens that you think the economy might slow down, but there's so much more to the story than that. You know, it's just you're operating under a totally incomplete framework.
Right. I mean, that's exactly right. You're looking at one side of of a balance sheet or an income statement and not looking at the other side, right? MMT is the only economic framework that recognizes that increased government spending equals private sector income. And so when the Fed raises rates on government debt, well, who predominantly owns the government's debt? Well, the households, firms, and municipalities in the United States. So effectively, everyone got a raise, whereas over the last decade, rates were close to zero. So right. The fact that you and I, I just remember just constantly texting back and forth, like, what are we missing here? Are we crazy? Why isn't this more widely talked about or known that when the Fed raises rates? And what's also shocking too is if you look at what it's supposedly supposed to do is slow down credit growth, right? Saying okay, the cost of capital is going higher, and so it's supposed to. But there's no evidence of that. I mean, if anything, credit growth accelerates because savers have more dollars in their accounts, right? At the end of the year or end of the quarter, whatever, because the rate has gone higher. So I just MMT is the only economic framework that recognizes rate hikes. And it depends also on other factors. For example, if debt is only 30% of GDP, well, it's not going to have as big of an impact.
Right.
The fact that it's over 100% of GDP means that it's the interest rate hikes are the sensitivity in terms of their and magnitude in terms of their impact on the economy is much higher, right? And what's also funny is and I've heard Warren Mosler make this example and say, okay, just recognizing this is absurd, but just to make an argument, what if the Fed hiked rates to 100%? Or alternatively, the debt as a percent of GDP went from 100% to 100%, or 100%, excuse me, to 1,000%, right. 10 times the size. I think most people would recognize that would be highly, highly, highly inflationary.
Right.
Because if you had interest rates at 100%, that means that the, the stock of the current balance of debt as a percent of GDP is higher than 100%. So the government would be paying out over 100% of GDP. So over 30, it'd be like $30 trillion a year in interest payments to the private sector, in an economy that has a annual GDP of like $25 trillion. Mm-hmm. So how can that possibly work to stem or to stop inflation?
Right.
It just doesn't make any sense.
Totally. Well, especially, one of the things that I've been thinking about is this idea that, I think kind of the mainstream narrative is that all this money was created during COVID and sent out to people in the form of stimulus checks or other programs. So people are very flush with cash and they're spending that cash, and that's what's driving up prices. So my question is, for people that think rate hikes will, temper spending, do people, if the thinking is that people already have money, then how does increasing rates affect their spending, right? Tell me, do people have the money or are they borrowing the money, right? From my perspective, that whole thing is kind of backwards as well. It's like, on one hand, we're saying that people have a ton of money on already. And on the other hand, we're saying that we need to stop people from borrowing to reduce their consumption in order to prevent inflation. So it just seems totally inconsistent to me. And I don't know if that's actually how the Fed thinks about it, but I think that's how a lot of people think monetary policy works.
Yeah, I don't know what the people at the Fed are thinking, frankly. I think the Fed just thinks that, you know, raising rates magically will slow borrowing because it's more expensive. Mm-hmm. But I think as Mosler has pointed out, higher rates just kind of raise the prices of everything in the economy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? If the cost of funding is higher, then everything is just going to be more expensive. And he loves to use this analogy of let's say you're a gold miner, and the price on gold is around $2,000 an ounce or something, and you know, you have a choice. You can sell it on the spot market, right? And so you take cash delivery today or at T+1, so I guess, you know, tomorrow. Or you could sell it a year in the future on the forwards market, you know, via some sort of forward contract. Mm-hmm. If interest rates are at zero, right, and you sell on the spot market, then and you take the cash and buy, a risk-free 1-year T-bill, you're going to make 0% on that cash, right?
Yep.
If rates are at 5%, okay, you take that cash, you buy a 1-year T-bill, you're making 5% on that.
Right.
So now, and economists love, and financial people love to talk about opportunity cost. Mm-hmm. So if you don't adjust your price, like when you're deciding to sell it, you know, on the spot market versus the forward market, if you don't adjust, you need to adjust the price that you would sell it on the forward market to recognize the opportunity cost of not having the savings and getting the 5% for free.
Right. Right.
Right. So that's going to make, you're going to demand additional compensation if you sell it on the on the forward market, if rates are at 5% or 10% versus if they're at 0%. And so that just makes what he calls the term structure prices. That just makes everything higher. Mm-hmm. What I would sort of kind of add to that is, you know, just like a let's say you're a large corporation. I mean, I remember reading after third quarter earnings were coming out, like Unilever, I think I sent this to you. Unilever reported 11% increase in prices, negative volumes year on year. So, right? So what happens is, a company, companies frequently finance themselves, right? They have to, they don't hold, the inventory balances go up and down, things are seasonal, right? And so you'll often use lines of credit or issue commercial, other short-term forms of debt, like commercial paper or something, to fund those, the working capital needs, right? So during the holidays, let's say you're a retailer and 2/3 of your sales come during the holiday season or maybe even more. You've got to draw on a line of credit usually from a bank to purchase the inventories ahead of time, right? And then you sell them, and then you take the proceeds, you pay the loan back to the bank. So
right.
And those loans, they get priced. Usually there's like a base rate, whether it's LIBOR or SOFR or what have you, they get priced at a spread over that base rate. So all of a sudden, if that base rate is way higher, right, then your interest expense on that that credit line that you're using to borrow to fund your inventories, that's gonna be a lot more. So in right. order for you to maintain your margins, because that's how companies price things, is they think about it in terms of margins. If they want to maintain their margins, they have to raise prices.
Right.
So that's where I really, like, even basic understandings of businesses would suggest that raising the cost of funding mm-hmm. raises prices.
Right.
And so, well, I don't understand. Yeah. Go ahead.
You would think that would be intuitive, just because, you know, it's a common talking point to say that, you know, if for example, taxes were raised on businesses, then businesses will raise prices. But, you know, if the Fed is raising rates, and they're increasing the cost of financing, isn't that the same, you know, isn't that at least similar operationally for the business?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it just depends on, you know, it impacts income distributions, right? Like,
right.
If they're raising rates, then that's going to come to the benefit of the lender. If they're raising taxes, that comes to the benefit, using benefit here, you know, with air quotes, to the sovereign, to the government.
Right.
Not that the government benefits from generating more revenues, but it you know, it just reflects higher revenue collections.
Right.
Yeah. So that, but yeah, they're you know, kind of functionally the same. They're functionally a tax. It's just a matter of who gets it. Is it the banker or the government?
Right. Right. Exactly. That's a good way to put it. So what I'm wondering at this point, and I'm actually starting to see this, at least in the media today, you know, with the news of with the GDP numbers coming out, I saw that Goldman said, I'm going to read the quote right now. Goldman said today, business surveys tend to underestimate growth when sentiment is particularly depressed and fears of imminent recession have been top of mind for several quarters. We expect continued growth in economic activity and employment this year, particularly now that the drag from tighter financial conditions is likely to have peaked. So my question is, what is it going to take for kind of this narrative to change? That a recession is coming, that we're waiting for this bad recession, that everyone knows it's coming and it's going to come any day now. I wonder what's going to, you know, what is it that's going to change it? Is it just going to be a gradual shift in sentiment and people are going to kind of forget that we were all talking about a recession for, I don't know, the last 6-8 months, a year? That's kind of what I'm curious about. And I think it's also important to recognize that, you know, it looks like we've passed peak inflation. It looks like inflation is getting down back to normal. And, you know, not long ago, like 3 months ago, people, big economists were saying we might have to see unemployment go up a few percentage points in order to reduce inflation. So it's like, if this stuff, you know, if inflation comes back to normal, if we don't see a recession, is all this commentary just going to be forgotten about? My guess is it will, and the sentiment will just change, and the kind of mainstream narrative on the economy as a whole will just gradually change. But I'm curious to see what happens there, and what are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I'll just point out that Jan Hatzius, the chief economist at Goldman, I don't know if you call him an MMT guy, but he's MMT adjacent. He has credited MMT with really and think about the economy in terms of sectoral balances and that whole framework as being very influential to his general framework and forecasting, and so something that I feel like, you know, people should know more, that the chief economist at Goldman is basically an MMT guy. But I don't know the answer. If I had to, about, you know, how the narrative will shift, if I had to guess, it's going to be exactly what you said. People will just start talking about other things. You know, the news cycle is generally pretty fast these days. And, you know, people will look back and say, oh, you know, There was you know, all this fears about recession and you know, everyone got it wrong. But, you know, no one could have actually predicted that, right? Yeah. Everyone, if everyone got it wrong, then no one could have known. Right. You know what's so funny is I was reading a report. Investigating a company, a stock that as part of my general research process, and I was reading old reports because I was like, you know, from right after they had gone public, they had actually been spun out from another company back in 2015. So, yeah. and this company, they're a chartered bank. They focus on consumer finance, and what was so funny is I'm reading this report from 2015, and literally this analyst says, you know, one of the biggest risks this is of recession.
Yeah.
You know, we really could be entering a recession right now. And so I don't know if this company is going to get, a multiple re-rating, but you know, it aside from 08, it's business held in, blah, blah, blah. But it's just like, you know, it's like, there's this perpetual fear of recession because of these just flawed models that are, and that's one thing I think that we really have to recognize is that the models and the assumptions for the models and that economists use, like, it's not that they are wrong, but those models and frameworks of analysis were useful in a prior period. They were useful, these kind of like more, you know, focus on austerity and stuff. That was useful under a gold standard, because under a gold standard, the United States government could not issue money in unlimited quantities, because it by law was restricted to, it promised its creditors that it would, always be able to convert dollars into gold. Right. At, you know, a price that it set. And so it wasn't until we officially untethered that relationship.
Yep.
That, we could see the full power of our fiat monetary system. And the problem is that people haven't changed their models or their frameworks. They're still using a map that assumes that the earth is flat, even though we know that it's round,
right.
That it's a sphere, right? So that's something that I think, like, you know, because it can be frustrating at times. So why do people think this way? Well, and the reason it's that is because it's so deeply ingrained, and, you know, things were taught a certain way for a long time, and it's just that's an old model that isn't relevant to the world that we live in anymore.
Yep.
And we can move past it.
Yeah, 100%. I'm wondering if do you remember post 2008 how the big descriptor for the economy was? I don't know. It might have been Larry Summers that came up with it. Was secular stagnation?
I remember hearing about it. I never really dug into the details of what he was saying.
I actually don't know what he meant or what the definition of secular stagnation is in an economist's mind, but to me it seemed like just a term that was used to explain the low growth after 2008, and it wasn't really rooted in reality. I mean, I think if you understand MMT, you can see that basically after the financial crisis, the government initially, you know, stimulated the economy and then went straight into austerity, and we had an incredibly long recovery as a result. And I think the mainstream was describing that as secular stagnation. And I guess what happened
with this long, slow recovery, you're saying?
The slow recovery, yeah, the very slow recovery, which was unnecessary, you know, and we saw that with COVID, we bounced back very quickly because the government took a lot of action. So I'm wondering if there's going to be another term to kind of describe what we're going through. I mean, I've already seen people calling this a white collar recession because, you know, Goldman's firing people and Google has fired people and all these other tech companies. But in my mind, it's more of just, you know, if anything, it's just a correction And I don't see it in the broader economy. You know, I see it in a handful of companies. And I actually sorry to interrupt, but I saw a pretty amazing stat. I think Goldman put this out actually. If all of the employees in the US economy that work in, I think it was internet search and media, so those two industries, if all those people lost their jobs, unemployment would go up 50 basis points. So it's like you're talking about such a small piece of the economy in the grand scheme of things. Granted, those people generally have high incomes and they probably support a lot of economic activity through their spending. But it's such a small piece compared to the whole picture. It just gets so much visibility in the media, you know?
Right. And but also like these companies kind of control the media or significant portions of the media, right? And what gets put out there. So I think, you know, I think, you know, ostensibly they can press their thumb on certain narratives and, you know, despite having all of these sort of legal protections or around, you know, being a platform company or what have you, I think it's pretty clear that these companies, for better or worse, ostensibly press their thumb and influence the content and information that gets disseminated. And so, I think that, you know, not to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but that has to have some sort of impact, right? You know, all these, the companies that control the media and the dissemination of information are going through layoffs, then, you know, it's probably likely that we're going to hear a lot about it.
Yeah.
And that's going to influence how people think.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, that makes total sense. One thing I would love to touch on is the debt ceiling talk. And kind of go into the mechanics of what's happening and, you know, the trillion-dollar coin solution. So if you are comfortable explaining the debt ceiling, would love to go into that.
Yeah, and again, there's people that understand this a lot better than I do in terms of the legal machinations and so forth. But my general understanding is that, you know, we have this sort of self-imposed debt ceiling policy that we've raised, I don't know, somewhere in the neighborhood of like 60 times over the last, you know, for decades, you know, dating back to like World War II, I think. At the same time, you have, you know, that law is, comes in conflict with the 14th Amendment, which says, you know, essentially the Treasury has to, by law, spend what Congress tells it to spend.
Right.
Okay. So you kind of have these sort of laws that are in conflict with one another. And this creates all sorts of political drama, and it's been used repeatedly by the Republicans as a means to cut public spending. And, you know, they were very successful actually in convincing or enforcing Obama to make, remember the do you remember the sequestration during the Obama administration?
Vaguely. What happened again?
They made cuts to the military and other public spending in return for the Republicans agreeing to raise the debt ceiling again. And so they're trying to do this again. Backing up for a second, and you know, you were talking about Larry Summers and secular stagnation. I mean, he was the one who told Obama, hey, like, we can't do $1 trillion stimulus package. Yep. Like people will freak out.
Right.
Right.
Which I think is a crazy anecdote that more people should know. So basically the story is that Larry Summers didn't want to go over $1 trillion just because $1 trillion sounds like a really big number. So I think the stimulus after 08, wasn't it something like a $982 billion bill?
I thought it was more like $800 billion, but maybe there were other, net effects or something. I don't remember exactly, but it was him who said, no, you can't do $1 trillion. Like, that's just like,
right.
Like right. Psychologically, no one will buy our debt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Course. We're going to freak the bond market out and then we won't be. So, and then we go through this sort of jobless recovery. And he can't figure out why we're having a jobless recovery, and so he blames it on someone else and says it's some sort of secular stagnation.
Secular stagnation.
Yeah, nothing to do with policies. So I would tend to think that he was highly influential in Obama's sort of narrative around saying that the government needs to tighten its belt. In solidarity with the families and the businesses that are tightening their belts right now during this hard time, not realizing that by the government tightening its belt, that is causing the financial stress and the belt tightening in the private sector.
Right.
Exactly. It's so sad and frustrating to look back and read some of this stuff. I mean, him talking about, us having a credit card with China. It's just like, it's so wrong. It's just factually just not correct.
Yep.
Like, China can't buy our debt unless it has dollars. It has dollars because we engage in trade with them. Right. So they send us their real resources. Right, real resources are a benefit, okay, and we send them a bank statement with a bunch of numbers on it saying dollars, okay, right. And then they take those dollars and rather than holding it in what's the equivalent to a checking account, they transfer it to a savings account when they purchase treasury securities. I mean, that's what is happening there. Mm-hmm. So getting back to this point about the debt ceiling. So it's a self-imposed thing that serves no actual financial purpose, and it's obsolete in a period where the dollar isn't tethered to any sort of other commodity or other currency, right? It's just it's a free floating currency that we control. So, we cannot, it's not like we can we can't default on our own debt involuntarily. Now, there's obviously political risk of defaulting on debt, right? If you get a bunch of psychos in there and just decide not to pay back the money that they owe to people who borrowed from them, there's obviously that is a possibility, but that would be a political choice that our elected officials make. There's no financial constraint. There's no creditor that can come to you and say that can shake you down for all your money and you say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I don't have any more." Right? It doesn't work the way a household or a business does, because the U.S. government is the monopoly supplier of dollars to the world. It's the original source of dollars.
Right.
Dollar bills get printed at the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. They're legally issued by the Fed. Yep. So anyway, getting back to it, and the Constitution actually is very clear. It says that the Congress has exclusive authority to coin money. And there's a law, the U.S. Mint, part of the U.S. Department of Treasury, was established in the Coinage Act of 1792. So we're talking about centuries before the establishment of the Fed or any sort of other contemporary, monetary arrangements and stuff that we have. And there was a law passed in the mid-90s that said that the mint could issue high proof coins of any denomination, but it had to be high proof, and it had to be platinum, right? And the thinking behind the law was that was sort of this kind of creating it was mostly used for like collector's coins and stuff, but the way that the law is written is such that the Treasury can essentially mint a coin of any denomination at once, as long as it's a high proof platinum coin. Mm-hmm. So what has been proposed, and I guess this somebody in a blog comment over a decade ago said, well, why doesn't the Treasury just mint $1 trillion coin and deposit it at the Fed? Right. And then so what happens, right? So if anyone makes a deposit, deposit's one of the worst terms ever created. It's just it's just confusing.
Yeah.
But essentially, and the way that Morgan Ricks, who's not like a MMT guy per se, but he's very much MMT adjacent, the way he describes it in his book is to think about banks as entities that or to think of deposits as an instrument that a bank issues, mm-hmm. right? Rather than something that it collects, right?
Yeah.
So the bank takes in this case, the Fed, which is the fiscal agent for the U.S. Treasury, would accept the platinum coin and issue a deposit a credit to the Treasury General Account in exchange for it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now the Fed holds the coin, the $1 trillion coin, as an asset on its balance sheet, and credits a reserve liability to the Treasury General Account. Now the Treasury can spend that money without having to issue debt, without having to issue Treasury securities. It can because I guess there are I don't know the specifics around I don't think the Treasury General Account is supposed to go below zero, but I also read recently that if the Treasury runs out of money, technically the Fed staffers have, as part of their operations manual, they're supposed to just book a negative balance.
Right.
Which is effectively a loan.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Even though the Fed's not supposed to lend to the Treasury. Anyway, this is all, that's my general understanding, is that, there is a legal and constitutional solution to this really stupid political crisis that we find ourselves in. I guess it upsets a lot of people because it's not really considered sophisticated. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen who also was head of the Fed, has called it a gimmick. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the Fed actually currently, this is a fun fact. So the Fed, because of the rapid rise in rates, the Fed's liabilities, so the interest it pays on reserves are now higher than the interest that it earns on its assets. So its assets are U.S. Treasuries, okay, and other agency mortgage-backed securities and stuff. So because of the rapid rise in rates, it's now paying out more on its liabilities than it generates on its assets. So it's actually operating at a loss. Yeah. Typically, it operates at a gain and remits 100% of those profits to the Treasury. Now it's operating at a loss. And so how does that work? Well, it just books a deferred asset to offset the operating loss liability. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, is that not ostensibly an accounting gimmick?
Right, 100%.
Right. So it was this very political thing about what gimmicks we choose to to solve these problems, right? Yeah. It seems legitimate to just book a deferred asset to offset an operating loss at the Fed, but you know, accepting a $1 trillion high proof platinum coin is considered heresy, right?
It's right.
It'll be interesting to see how this showdown kind of plays out, right? I guess there are quote unquote extensive measures that the Treasury can take. I haven't looked exactly what that means. But essentially, you know, it can continue paying its obligations until about without issuing treasuries until around June or so it projects. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, this how this political situation plays out. Biden has come out adamantly that they will not be cutting any spending. Essentially telling the Republicans to stand down. Janet Yellen, to her credit, while she calls the coin solution a gimmick, she has not ruled it out and has not said that it's illegal, right? And that brings up the question of, okay, you know, because there's different potential solutions, right? Like some people have said, well, you know, the Biden administration could just ignore the debt ceiling.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it has these two laws that are incompatible with one another. On the one hand, Congress has mandated by law that they spend these dollars, that they make these payments. And on the other hand, says that the Treasury is not allowed to issue securities that would, you know, bring reserves back into its general account that would be used to actually make the payments.
Right.
It's more of just like a bookkeeping thing than anything else. And so those laws are incompatible. So, you know, there's a legal theory that the Biden administration could just ignore the debt ceiling in favor of, you know, the 14th Amendment. And the point about the coin is that it is a constitutional solution. It's a legal solution. So,
yeah.
So in a sense, like Biden and Jenny Allen are obligated by law to do this because there is no other. I guess there have been other things that have been proposed, like some sort of high rate, low face value treasury security.
Yeah.
Because of the way that the law is written is like it looks at face value more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, like the platinum coin solution is cleaner. And as a reminder, these payments are for laws that have already been passed, right? Like people will try to say things like, "Oh, this is, you know, this is inflationary." Well, no, it's just meeting the funding obligations that you have already committed to. There's no additional dollars being injected into the economy. If anything, if you start financing things with platinum coins that don't earn it any interesting income, then the government wouldn't have to pay interest.
Yeah.
And so that would actually be deflationary,
right?
Right, because it would cut off the interest paid on currently pays interest on debt securities. You would cut that off, and we're here kind of saying that, yeah, I think the interest paid on the government's debt has actually been helpful in avoiding a recession.
Right, exactly.
Because it's added to the deficit. It's added to the private sector surplus.
Right.
It's accruing in real people's bank accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Every single day, your savings balance is growing because the government is paying a higher rate on its debt.
Right.
And that's helping keep us out of a recession. And that's something that, like, yeah. Anyway, so that's the deal with the coin. And one other thing I would just like to say, kind of building off how we finished last week's episode, is like Thomas Jefferson was adamant about how, you know, like minting coins as money it's not like a purely utilitarian exercise. It's very symbolic in the sense that it's a declaration of your sovereignty, right? You stamp your face on the coin and it's a declaration of your freedom. And yeah. So for people who try to say like, this is un-American, this is un-serious, I would just point out that that's completely inconsistent with the founders and with what Thomas Jefferson in particular would have said.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a great point. That's a great point. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I suspect that, you know, the Democrats will make some kind of concessions and they'll ultimately, you know, agree to extend the debt ceiling like they always do, and everything will be fine. But I've been wrong in my political predictions before, so who knows? Who knows? It's until what, until late fall that they have to figure it out.
Oh, I thought it was till June.
Is it till June? I was thinking it was till September for some reason, but maybe it is until June.
Well, September would be the end of the fiscal year.
Yeah.
So maybe that's right, but I had read that it's until June.
Okay.
But again, I could be wrong about that. But yeah, no, it'll be interesting to see what becomes of this. It seems like Biden is trying to hold firm.
Yeah.
And he obviously has ambitious spending plan. Like he wants to see, you know, the dollars go to work. You know, that was passed in the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act. So, you know, but in my opinion, they should just mint the coin and get this over with, because it's just why wait? Like, just let's just end this, you know,
charade,
unnecessary, yeah, self-imposed crisis, and just move on.
Right.
There's so many other things, you know, good things. I mean, think about this for a second, right? So. So the early estimates for fourth quarter GDP growth was 2.9%. Mm-hmm. Okay. That is coming off of a very high base, right? Like, we had very high economic growth in 2021. So you kind of had a little dip in the first half of 2022, and then it came back in a significant fashion, 3.2% in third quarter, 2.9% in fourth quarter. Okay. Those are solid GDP prints. I mean, I remember, Larry Kudlow, you know, he was the head of the National Economic Advisors or whatever to the Trump administration. He's like a Wall Street guy, right? So he kind of, you know, went around saying that, like, okay, like, you know, we're shooting for 3% full year GDP growth. Mm-hmm. And in a very kind of, you know, Wall Street fashion, it's like, okay, here are the numbers. It's like a company saying, okay, here's our earnings per share projections. This is what we're aiming for. And then, you know, the analyst can kind of use that as a benchmark for how they did, right? And can kind of say, oh, you know, did they hit their numbers or not? Well, ostensibly, the Trump administration never hit that 3% goal for a full year. And yeah. So I don't understand why that isn't widely – more widely talked about. It's like, where are the tough Wall Street guys saying, like, hey, you didn't hit your numbers?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But right. but B, like so 3%, that was like their goal, and yeah. They couldn't even hit it. Biden just did that, you know, over 3% run rate for the back half of 2022.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like that's such an important context over the state of the economy. And meanwhile, you have people running around like screaming recession, and they're putting up better GDP growth numbers than the Trump administration ever did.
Right. Right.
Right. So
yeah.
It's like, it's just amazing the gaslighting that goes on in terms of communicating all this stuff.
It really is.
Going back to your point about like the white collar recession. I mean, I went to a financials conference hosted by Goldman a little over a month ago, and Brian Moynihan, the CEO of Bank of America, was there, and he may have been borrowing this from someone else, but he was like, yeah, you know, we had this sort of jobless recovery in 2010, 11, 12. Well, we may have an employment-less recession in 2023.
What does that mean?
Well, what's interesting is like he was kind of saying like, you know, business is really good. The consumer's in great shape. They're spending money. They have, you know, their savings balances are multiples of what it was pre-COVID, right? There was all this talk before the pandemic about how, you know, so few Americans have even $400 to meet like an emergency.
Yeah.
So he was saying that the average savings balance is multiples of what it was pre-COVID for people, and they're spending money and things look pretty good. And he was like, but, you know, my economists say that we're having a recession next year, and, you know, we expect to enter in the first quarter, and for to last three quarters, and it'll be mild, and then we'll be done. So that's, he's kind of saying like, business is really good. My economist says this. Like,
yeah.
He's not going to throw him under the bus, right? But it's sort of like, you know, take it as you. So that's why he's just like, yeah, I guess we'll have like an unemployment less recession. I mean, we kind of already had that.
Yeah.
Right. There was all this talk about, you know, oh, the BLS is changing the rules for the Biden administration last year when it, you know, it, or I guess, is it the BLS or that's a BEA? That determines whether you know, country's in recession or not. You know, because we had two quarters of GDP declines in the first half of 2022. Now, what was noticeably missing from anyone who you know isn't familiar with MMT in terms of the narratives and discussions around you know, the GDP contraction in the first half of 2022 is the fact that the U.S. Treasury collected literally record tax receipts in the first half of 2022. I mean, mm-hmm. April itself was the largest monthly collection of taxes ever, and that coincided with a drop off in public spending programs year on year. Right, because you had these big stimulus programs in 2021. They were not repeated. Even like the I forget exactly what it was, but like the child credit tax credit thing that ensured kids wouldn't go hungry. That was unfortunately cut off in the beginning of 2022. So you had this huge drop off in federal spending combined with literally the largest tax receipts ever in the first half of a year. And that was a combination of some one-off things, right? Like really, really high capital gains taxes, right? A lot of people sold businesses and a lot of companies went public in 2021. People were sitting on huge capital gains taxes, so they had to pay the tax man come April 2022. So you have this. So to me, that is the tightening.
Yeah.
Right? That I mean, ostensibly, you're taking dollars out of people's bank accounts and you're transferring them to the Treasury's account, the Fed. And so Americans had less dollars. And Biden was going around saying, you know, we reduced the deficit. We reduced the deficit. I mean, they reduced the deficit by $1 trillion. That's ostensibly true.
Right.
And hopefully people have heard that and they're like, and know that I'm not just, you know, blowing smoke over here. The Democrats have been hammering that narrative home. Well, guess what? When you reduce the government deficit, that means you're reducing the private sector surplus. So that causes a financial tightening. And then what also happened was the war in Ukraine had this energy spike, right? So, I mean, things were horrible in the summer. You know, gas prices went nuts. Americans weren't spending. It was just a lot of them were just like, this is too expensive. So you had this double whammy tightening of, you know, tax receipts and, you know, energy price spikes, and also maybe to an extent, like, you know, the stock market kind of rolled over, that may have had an impact on, you know, just people's moods. I don't know if it actually impacted spending behaviors. You know, I was just reading this past weekend that luxury retail sales hit another record high in 2022, right. despite all the stuff about the wealth effects and everything else. Retail luxury sales made another record in 2022, and that's, I mean, we could spend an entire episode kind of talking about that, but you know, so that's how you know, to sum up 2022 is you sort of had this massive fiscal tightening in the first half. You had two quarters of negative GDP. Now I get it, there are anomalies, you know, it's something about like inventories and or lack of inventory growth as a drag on GDP and what have you. So, but you know, we had, you know, huge, I think millions of jobs created and ended the year with record low unemployment rates. And so that's why it wasn't called a recession. That's why people are making up these terms like a unemployment less recession or like a white collar only recession. I mean, by the way, the characterization of this as being like a white collar recession is not like a, that's actually not a terrible characterization. I mean, I haven't looked at the latest figures, but the last time I looked at unemployment rates in, which I think was, you know, Q3, you know, unemployment rates in energy, mining and quarrying, then those sectors, it was less than 1%.
Wow.
Like it was 0.9%.
Yeah.
Unemployment rate. So people working in, you know, the, you know, real industries and such, they all have jobs,
right?
It's just like kind of tech and finance that's having like a little bit of a contraction right now. So,
which, by the way, you know, everyone was mocking all those companies for over hiring or for offering, you know, insane benefits, and then suddenly they decide to cut costs, and people see it as a sign of, you know, economy-wide recession, which I don't understand.
Right. I think a lot of those workers, you know, software engineers and stuff, I think they will probably relocate to, you know, maybe doing similar work in other parts of the economy. Maybe other corporations need to beef up their tech infrastructure, and they, yeah, you know, they need better software solutions and stuff. And that'll probably be a net positive, right? Is to distribute these talented people, you know, across different sectors of the economy. I think that would be a wonderful thing.
The Southwest Airlines thing is a good example of that, like how their whole system crashed because the tech was so outdated. Right. Now they have an opportunity to hire, you know, some engineers from Google. So maybe it'll be a net positive.
I think that's a great point. You know, one other thing, Adam, that I want to point out is something to think about, and maybe you know, we don't have to, you know, this is something we could touch on too at a later episode. But so one company that I follow is H&R Block.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is like they'll release these reports on, you know, kind of like, because they have all this data, they collect all this tax, you know, payment data and stuff. So they have a really kind of intimate look at what's going on in the U.S. economy. And they released this report pointing out that so many Americans are turning to either ride sharing,
yeah,
or like Airbnbs as sources of income. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when you think about that, like that is a completely new phenomenon, and there's millions of Americans that are doing this. It's growing, you know, I think 40-ish% a year or something like that. And when you think about that, like, you're going to, if your car or your house or your second house or, you know, your, you know, carriage house or whatever is a significant source of income, you are going to invest to support that income.
Right.
So I think this is kind of an underappreciated concept that we might, you know, it's something I'm going to be keeping my eye on is like, you know, how much are Americans spending to, you know, keep their, you know, if you run an Airbnb, like you gotta keep it, you can't just let things fall apart, right? Otherwise, you're going to get horrible reviews and people are going to have bad experiences and they're not going to come back. So it's kind of an interesting new dynamic at play that could be kind of a boost for like, you know, investments in people's homes and autos and stuff. So just kind of something to think about that and how and another reason why, you know, maybe things aren't so horrible.
yeah, for sure. All right, Ryan, I think we should wrap it there. It's been about an hour. Anything you want to close with?
No. This has been great. Yeah, let's keep it rolling.
For sure. And everyone who's listening, thank you for listening. If you're listening on YouTube, it'd be great if you could subscribe. And we will see you next time. Thanks so much.